Chapter 22. Lawrence of Arabia calling Beau Geste. Come in, Beau. So exhausted by the past 48 hours, and especially the past 12, Cabrillo had forgotten all about the tactical radio he was wearing, and for a moment thought he was hearing voices. Then he remembered that Lawrence of Arabia was Link's call sign. Damn, Larry, Juan radioed back. Am I glad to hear you. Just saw an explosion at the main gates and looks like our new allies are sweeping in.
Affirmative. What's your position?
We're about 3 miles out at 5,000 feet. Eagle Eye Gunderson saw the blast. Are you ready for us to land yet?
That's a negative, Cabrillo replied. I still have to secure our passengers, and we need to make sure Mafana's men can keep the guards bottled up long enough for you to come in.
No problem. We'll keep circling, Link said, then added with humor in his deep baritone, Danger pays by the hour anyway. Juan slammed a fresh magazine into the receiver of his MP5 and racked the bolt to chamber around. Before anyone else tried to outflank him by climbing onto the roof, he dashed to where his parachute billowed over the outside wall of the prison, one end held fast by one of the eye bolts his men had installed earlier. When this was supposed to have been a simple, clandestine hostage rescue from a bunch of long-haired eco-terrorists. The battle in the courtyard now sounded like World War III, as the Zimbabweans fought each other in such close quarters that their assault rifles were used as clubs as much as guns. Clutching the fabric of the chute, Juan slipped over the edge of the roof so his feet dangled 3 stories above the desert floor. He lowered himself slowly and carefully. The nylon was as slick as silk. When he reached the end of the writhing mass of parachute cloth, he was still a good 3 feet above the window opening. He planted his boots against the wall, tucked his knees against his chest, and kicked off as hard as he could. His body pendulumed away from the prison for nearly 10 feet before gravity took hold of him and sent him careening back toward the building. It felt like his knees would explode when he slammed into the rough stone, but the experiment told him he could make the attempt, but his timing would have to be perfect. Again, he flexed his legs and launched himself into space, his grip on the chute like iron. When he reached the apex of his swing, he focused on nothing but the dark opening that gave entry into the prison. He started arcing down, building up speed, and more importantly, angular momentum. Like a stone released from a sling, Juan let go when his feet were pointed at the window. He flew through the window, clearing the bottom sill by inches and smashed onto the floor, rolling until he came up hard against the iron railing that overlooked the floors below. The sound of his body slamming into the loose railing echoed in the cavernous cell block. He groaned as he got to his feet, knowing that in a couple of hours his back was going to be zebra-striped with evenly spaced purple bruises. Feeling no need to be stealthy in this block of cells after such a loud entrance, Cabrillo rushed down the stairs. He already knew from Eddie's reports to Link that this particular section of the prison was empty. On the ground floor, he paused at the open door, checking the hallway in both directions, thankful that the generator was still powering the lights. When he started off to the right, he took the precaution of smashing the exposed bulbs as he went. He had no intention of leaving the prison the way he had come in, and he didn't want to make it any easier for a guard who managed to enter through the blown-up doorways. He peered around a corner, saw a chair outside a large door, exactly how Eddie had described the scene where they were holding Merrick. Although their original mission had been to rescue the scientist, Cabrillo's first obligation now rested with getting Moses Ndebele to safety. He trotted past the door, imagining that Merrick's kidnappers were holed up inside, not knowing how to react to the unfolding situation.
The prison never really shed the heat it absorbed during the torturous days, and now that the dawn had arrived, the passageway was growing hotter. Sweat ran from Cabrillo's pores as he jogged. He was halfway down the long hall when motion ahead caught his eye. Two slightly built guards ran toward him from the opposite direction. They were much closer to the entrance to the next cell block than Cabrillo, and their presence told him that this was where they were holding their prize prisoner. Juan dove flat, his elbows scraping against the stone floor as he aimed his machine pistol. He fired a wild spray that forced the soldiers back the way they'd come and around another bend. They must have climbed through the debris piled outside the doors, he thought absently, and tried to ignore the fact he was too exposed and outgunned. He slithered back to where the hallway was much darker and rolled to the opposite wall to confuse them. He fired every time one of the guards tried to check the hallway, filling the air with the stench of burned gunpowder. The area around the chairman was littered with stumpy brass shell casings. He slid across the hall again a moment before one of the soldiers laid down a blistering barrage of cover fire. Bits of stone and hot copper bullets seemed to fill the corridor. Juan tried to suppress the burst of auto fire with a return volley, but the guard hung tough and continued to shoot. His partner dashed from around the corner to add his gun. While neither of them could see Cabrillo in the darkened passage, the chance of a lucky shot doubled. The first guard broke from his position and raced for the entrance to the cell block. Either the door hadn't been locked or he'd shot away the mechanism because he disappeared inside before Juan could take him down. Cabrillo had seconds before the guard assassinated Moses and Debele. In what must have seemed like reckless rage, he launched himself from the floor and out of the murky shadows. His gun spit flame as he ran, firing from the hip. The beam from his laser sight was a ruby line cutting through the smoke. It finally settled on the guard's torso. The next three rounds hit center mass and tossed him off his feet. Cabrillo kept sprinting. Rather than slow to enter through the open door to the cell block, he careened off the stout jamb, absorbing the blow on his shoulder with barely a check-in speed. A line of cells was directly in front of him, each enclosure fronted by iron bars. They all appeared empty. For all he knew, Indebele could be on the second or third floor, and the guard had too much of a head start to find him. Then, over the sounds of his ragged breathing and hammering heart, he heard voices coming from behind the cells. The voice was melodious, soothing, not the plaintive cries of the condemned, but rather the fatherly understanding of a priest granting absolution. He raced around the corner. The guard was just outside of one of the cells while a man wearing a filthy prison uniform stood next to the bars, not 2 feet away from the soldier aiming at his head with an AK-47. Moses Ndebele stood calmly, with his arms at his side as if he weren't facing his executioner, but rather talking with a friend he hadn't seen in a while. Juan raised his gun to his shoulder, the laser never wavering from the guard's shiny forehead as the African turned at the sound of Cabrillo coming to a halt 30 feet away. The soldier started to draw down on his weapon in order to engage, but wouldn't have the time before Juan pulled the trigger. The bolt crashed against an empty chamber. The click of metal on metal was loud, but at the same time, nothing compared to what was supposed to happen. The guard had his weapon aimed halfway between Juan and Moses and Debele. He wasted a half second of thought between his sworn duty and the need to eliminate Cabrillo. He must have figured he could riddle the main rival of his nation's dictator and still gun down Juan before Cabrillo could reload the machine pistol or draw a handgun because he started to turn back toward Debele. Juan let the heckler and cock drop from his hands and kicked his artificial limb up into his chest so he could wrap his hands around his calf, his knee braced against his shoulder as though he were holding a gun. The barrel of the soldier's AK was just a couple of arc degrees from pointing at Ndebele when Juan's fingers found a button recessed into the tough plastic exterior of his combat leg. It was a safety device that allowed him to depress another button on the opposite side of the limb. Integrated within the prosthesis was one more trick Kevin Nixon in the Oregon's magic shop had devised. An 18-inch-long nickel pipe in .44 caliber. The dual triggers guaranteed the weapon would never discharge accidentally. When Juan hit the second one, the single shotgun went off with an explosion that shook dirt from the rafters and blew a nearly half-inch hole through the bottom of his boot. The recoil sent him tumbling. He picked himself up quickly, yanking at his pants cuff so he could draw the Kel-Tec 380 automatic pistol. He needn't have bothered. The hollow .44 caliber slug had hit the guard in the right arm as he stood in profile to Cabrillo and transited his entire body through his chest cavity, shredding his internal organs. The exit wound in his opposite shoulder was the size of a dinner plate. Moses and Ndebele looked at Juan in stunned silence as the chairman rammed a fresh magazine into his machine pistol and returned the Kel-Tec to its hiding place inside his leg. There were blood splatters on his prison uniform and a trickle of crimson on one cheek. Juan noticed the burn marks on Ndebele's bare arms, the swelling around his eyes and mouth, and how he stood with all his weight on one leg. Juan looked down at Ndebele's bare feet. One was normal. The other was so swollen it resembled a football. He guessed every bone from ankle to toe had been broken. "Mr. Ndebele, I am here with an army of your followers headed by a man named Mafana. We're getting you out of here." The African leader shook his head. "The damned fool. I told him when they first imprisoned me not to try something like this, but I should have known he wouldn't listen. My old friend Mafana chooses the orders he wishes to obey." Juan motioned him away from the cell door so he could shoot the lock open. Ndebele had to hop to keep his damaged foot from touching the ground. "I've got a friend named Max who pulls the same thing on me." Juan glanced up to catch Ndebele's eye. "And more often than not, he's right about which ones to disregard." He popped two rounds into the old iron lock and gave the door a heave. It slid open on protesting hinges. Ndebele made to hobble out of the cell, but Juan held up a hand. "We're going out another way." When researching the Devil's Oasis, Linda Ross had come across the account of a prisoner who tried to widen the 6-inch sewer holes inside the lower-tier cells. A prison trustee checked them every other day, and when he found that the man had used a spoon or other implement to scrape away at the foot-thick stone in order to make the hole big enough to escape through, he immediately reported it to the guards. They systematically crammed the prisoner down the small opening, breaking whatever bones necessary until only his head remained inside the cell. No one else ever tried to escape that way again. Juan handed the MP5 to Ndebele, asking him to cover them, and sat next to the hole. He hurriedly took off his boot and retrieved the remainder of his cache of plastic explosives. He molded the plastic into a long strand that he affixed in a ring at the bottom of the hole. He plucked the detonator from behind his leg's ankle joint and set the timer for 1 minute, enough time to lead Ndebele safely away. With his boot in hand, he stuck the timer into the soft explosive and left the cell with Moses draped over his shoulder in order to protect the man's foot. The bomb went off like a volcano, sending a geyser of flame, smoke, and chunks of stone high enough to ricochet off the ceiling. Cabrillo had his boot back on, but didn't bother to lace it when he returned to the cell. As he'd anticipated, the charge had been more than enough for the job. The hole was now 5 feet wide, its jagged edges blackened by the blast. He dropped through the opening and helped Ndebele descend. The man sucked air through his teeth when his broken foot brushed against the ground under the prison. "You okay?"
"I think maybe when the time comes I will ask you where you got your artificial leg. I don't think I will have this foot much longer."
"Don't worry. I know a pretty good doctor."
"He can't be that good if you lost your leg."
"Believe me, she is. She only started working for me after my original was blown off."
Together they struggled through the tunnel that allowed the constant desert winds to desiccate the human waste that once fell from above and eliminate the need for emptying slop buckets. The confines were tight and they had to crawl on elbows and knees in the dirt. Juan led them to the eastern side of the prison, closest to the airstrip. Fortunately, the wind was at their backs, so the blowing sand didn't scour their faces. It took 5 minutes to reach the perimeter of the building. The sunlight glaring through the opening was especially bright after the dim confines of the penitentiary. The two men lay side by side just short of the opening. Cabrillo keyed his radio.
"Beau geste to Lawrence of Arabia. Can you hear me, Larry?"
5x5, Beau," Link answered back. "What's your situation?"
"I have the native guest with me now. We've made it to the exterior wall. I'm looking at the airstrip. Give me 15 minutes to secure the primary target and come pick us up. Our boys will know to make a break for it when they see the plane."
"Negative, Beau. From the looks of it, our allies are taking a hell of a pounding in there. They won't last 15 minutes. I'm coming in now."
"Then give me 10 minutes.
Chairman, I ain't fooling. You don't have it. If we don't come in now, there won't be enough of Mafana's men left to count on one finger. This wasn't a suicide operation. We owe it to them to cover their retreat."
Even as Link spoke, the big cargo plane arrowed out of the sky.
"I've also just gotten word from Max that our situation has changed somewhat."
By landing now, Link had forced Cabrillo's hand. Moses would never make it to the airstrip unaided. Juan would have to carry him. The plane was too vulnerable on the ground to wait for him to return to the prison and rescue Jeffrey Merrick. And as soon as Mafana and his men began their retreat from the prison, the guards would swarm after them in hot pursuit. Without aerial cover, they would be slaughtered out on the open desert. As for whatever change Max Hanley was talking about, Juan would have to trust that his second-in-command had a much better grasp of the overall operational picture. The old de Havilland Caribou was an awkward-looking aircraft, with a rudder that was as tall as a three-story building and a cockpit hunched over a blunt nose. The high wings allowed for it to carry a large payload for its size and also to make incredibly short takeoff and landing runs. The particular aircraft Tiny Gunderson had rented was painted white, with a faded blue strip running the length of the fuselage. Juan saw that his chief pilot had lined up on the runway for his final approach. It was time to go. "Come on," he said to Moses and Ndebele, and crept out from their position under the prison. The sound of gunfire in the courtyard was muted by the building's thick walls, but it still sounded as though 1,000 men were in a fight for their lives. When both men were on their feet, Juan transferred his H&K to his left hand and stooped to lift the African leader over his shoulder. Ndebele was a tall man, but years of imprisonment had shrunk him to little more than skin and bones. He couldn't have weighed more than 120 pounds. Normally, Cabrillo wouldn't have had a problem carrying such a burden. However, his body was exhausted by hours of unrelenting abuse. Juan straightened his legs, his mouth a tight, grim line. Once he had Ndebele settled on his shoulder, he took off in a loping gait. His boots sank into the sand as he jogged, taxing his quivering legs and aching back with every pace. He kept a wary eye on the side of the prison where the entrance doors were located, but so far none of Mafana's men had tried to flee. They remained engaged with the guards, knowing that the longer they gutted it out, the better chance their leader had of escaping. The 70-foot-long twin-engine cargo plane touched down when Cabrillo was halfway to the landing strip. Tiny reversed the pitch of the propellers and gunned the motors, kicking up a veritable sandstorm with the prop wash that completely obscured the aircraft. The maneuver cut the distance he needed to land to less than 600 feet, leaving more than enough room to take off into the wind without backtracking to the end of the runway. Gunderson feathered the props so they no longer bit into the air, but barely cut power to the 1,500-horsepower engines. The airframe shuddered with unreleased energy. Motion to Juan's left caught his eye. He glanced over to see one of Mafana's trucks emerge from the prison. Men in the back continued to fire into the courtyard while the driver raced for the plane. Moments later, the other three trucks appeared. They weren't going anywhere near as fast. The rescuers were trying to further delay the guards from breaking out. Juan turned his attention back to the caribou. The cargo ramp was coming down, Franklin Lincoln standing at its very tip with an assault carbine in his hands. He waved Juan on, but kept his attention focused on the approaching truck. There was another black man with him, one of Mafana's men whom Juan had sent to rendezvous with the plane the night before. The ground under Cabrillo's feet firmed as he reached the gravel runway, and he put on a burst of speed, adrenaline allowing him to ignore the pain for a few minutes more. Juan reached the plane and lurched drunkenly up the ramp a few seconds before the lead truck braked just beyond the edge of the ramp. Doc Huxley was waiting with her medical cases. She'd strung saline drip bags to a wire running along the ceiling, the cannulas ready to replace any blood the fighters had lost. Juan laid Ndebele on one of the nylon mesh bench seats and turned to see what he could do to help. Link already had the truck's rear gate open. There were a dozen wounded men strewn on the floor, and over the sound of the roaring engines, Juan could hear their agony. Blood drizzled from the tailgate. Lincoln lifted the first man out and carried him into the aircraft's hold. Ski was right behind him, lugging another of the wounded. Mike and Eddie carried a third between them, a great bear of a man with blood saturating his pants from the thighs down. Juan helped an ambulatory man step to the ground. He cradled his arm to his chest. It was Mafana, and his face was ashen, but when he saw Moses Ndebele sitting up against a bulkhead, he cried out in joy. The two wounded men greeted each other as best they could. Back at the prison, the remaining trucks from the original convoy took off into the desert, their wheels kicking up spiraling columns of dust. Moments later, two other vehicles emerged. One of them started after the fleeing four-wheel drives, while the second turned for the airstrip. "Chairman!" Link shouted over the noise as he stepped onto the ramp carrying another of the injured. "Last one! Tell Tiny to get us out of here!" Juan waved in acknowledgement and threaded his way forward. Tiny was leaning out of his seat, and when he saw Cabrillo give him a thumbs up, he turned his attention back to the controls. He slowly changed the propeller's angle of attack, and the big aircraft began to roll. Cabrillo headed aft again. Julia was cutting away one man's bush jacket to expose a pair of bullet holes in his chest. The wounds bubbled. His lungs had been punctured. Undaunted by the unsanitary conditions or the bumpiness of the takeoff, she got to work on triage. "Did you have to leave it to the last second?" Eddie asked when Juan approached. He was grinning. Cabrillo shook his outstretched hand. "You know what a procrastinator I can be. You guys okay?" "Couple more gray hairs, but none the worse. One of these days you're going to have to tell me how you rustled up an army in the middle of nowhere." "Great magicians never divulge their secrets." The plane continued to pick up speed and was soon outpacing the guard's truck. Through the open ramp, Juan could see them fire off a few rounds in frustration before the driver braked hard and turned to give chase to the rest of Mafana's men. A third and then fourth truck roared out of the prison gate after them. Tiny hauled back on the yoke, and the old caribou lifted off the rough field. The vibrations that had built until Juan was sure he'd lose a filling finally evened out. Mindful that the ramp would have to remain open, the patients were moved to the front of the aircraft, leaving the area at the rear open. Link stood on the ramp, a safety line stretching from a D-ring on the floor to the rear of his combat vest. He wore a helmet with a microphone so he could talk with Tiny in the cockpit. There was a long crate at his feet. Juan clipped himself in, too, and cautiously approached the big seal. Hot wind whipped through the cabin as Tiny banked the plane to come in behind the guards' vehicles. With their newer trucks, they had already eaten away half the lead Mafana's troops had managed to gain on them. The trucks were approaching a deep valley between towering dunes when the plane hurtled over the two sets of vehicles. There was less than a half mile separating them. Tiny kept them at 1,000 feet as he flew along the length of the valley, but in an instant the valley came to a sudden end. Rather than opening up again onto open desert, the valley was only 3 miles long, a dead end. Its head was a sloping dune so steep that the trucks would have to slow to a walking pace to reach the summit. "Bring us around again," Link shouted into his mic. "Come up behind them." He motioned for Mike and Eddie to join them. The two men quickly got themselves secured, leaning over to maintain their balance as the plane banked around. Link opened the crate. Inside were four of Mafana's RPGs. They were the reason Juan had sent one of Mafana's men to hook up with Link. Link handed one of the rocket-propelled grenade launchers to each of them. "This is going to have to be some pretty fancy shooting," Mike shouted dubiously. "Four trucks. 4 RPGs. We're doing 120 miles an hour, and they must be close to 50. "Ye of little faith," Link yelled back. The plane evened out again at the entrance to the valley. Tiny took them lower, fighting updrafts of hot air lofting off the desert floor. The dunes flashed by no more than 100 feet from the wingtips. Link was listening to the pilot as he counted down how long it would be before they shot over the guard's convoy. When he lifted the RPG to his shoulder, the other three did likewise. He pointed at Juan and Ski. "Aim at the base of the dune to the left of the convoy. Mike and I will take the right. Drop the grenades about 20 yards in front of the lead vehicle." Tiny took them lower still, and then gained elevation quickly when the plane came under fire from below. He steadied the caribou just as they passed the last truck in line. For a fleeting second, Juan and the others were looking down at the convoy, and it appeared that every gun the guards had was blazing away at them. "Now!" They triggered the RPGs simultaneously. The 4 rockets popped from their tubes and ignited, their white contrails corkscrewing through the clear air. The plane had overshot Mafana's trucks by the time the warheads slammed into the base of the dunes. The shaped charges went off in blinding eruptions of sand. And while they seemed puny compared to the massive scale of the dunes, the explosions had their desired effect. The equilibrium of angle and height that held the dunes in place was thrown off by the blasts. A trickle of sand began to slide down each face, accelerating and growing until it looked like both sides of the canyon were racing for each other. And caught in the middle was the guard's convoy. The twin landslides crashed onto the valley floor. The right side avalanche had been going a bit faster than its partner, so when it slammed into the convoy, the 4 vehicles were blown onto their sides. Men and weapons were tossed from the beds of the trucks, only to be struck by the second wall of sand as it careened into them, burying everything under 30 or more feet of earth. A cloud of dust was all that marked their grave. Link hit the button to close the ramp, and all four men stepped back.
"What did I tell you?"
Link grinned at Mike.
"Piece of cake."
"Lucky thing this valley was here," Mike retorted.
"Lucky my butt.
I saw it when I hightailed it out last night. Juan had Mafana's men drive here specifically so we could take out all the guards in one fell swoop."
"Pretty slick, Chairman," Trono conceded.
Juan didn't try to hide his self-satisfied smile.
"That it was. That it was."
He turned his attention back to Lincoln. "Does Max have everything set?"
"The Oregon's tied to the dock in Svakopmund. Max will meet us at the airport with a flatbed truck carrying an empty shipping container. We load the wounded in and hop aboard ourselves. Max will then drive down to the wharf, where a customs inspector with a pocket bulging with bakshish will sign off on the bill of lading, and we get hoisted onto the ship."
"And Mafana's men are going to drive through to Windhoek," Juan concluded, "where they can fly out to wherever we can find Ndebele a safe haven." His tone soured. "All well and good, except we didn't rescue Jeffrey Merrick and have lost any chance to find him again. I'm sure his kidnappers left the Devil's Oasis 5 seconds after the guards."
"Ye of so little faith," Link said for the second time with a sad shake of his head.
Nina Visser was sitting in the shade of a tarp anchored to the bed of their truck when she heard a buzzing sound. She had been writing in her journal, a habit she'd kept up since her early teens. She'd filled volumes of notebooks over the years, knowing someday it would be an important resource for her biographer. That she would be important enough to need a book written about her life was something she'd never doubted. She was going to be one of the great champions of the environmental movement, like Robert Hunter and Paul Watson, Greenpeace's co-founders. Of course, the current operation wouldn't be included. This was one blow she would strike from the shadows. She was only writing out of habit and knew she would have to destroy this journal and any others that mentioned her involvement with Dan Singer's scheme. She closed the notebook and slid her pen into the spiral binding. Crawling out from under the tarp was like opening the door of an oven. The afternoon sun beat down mercilessly. She stood, dusted off the seat of her pants, and shielded her eyes from the sun, searching the sky for the plane Danny had promised. Even with dark sunglasses, it took her a few seconds to spot the little jewel glinting in the sky. A couple of her friends crawled out from the tarp to join her, including Susan. They were all tired from the drive and thirsty because they hadn't packed enough water. Merrick was faring the worst since he was bound and gagged and left leaning against the side of the truck where there was only a sliver of shadow. He hadn't gained consciousness since being injected with the heroin, and his sunburned face was rimed with dried sweat. Flies buzzed around his wound. The plane made a pass of the dirt runway, and everyone waved as it overshot them. The pilot wagged the aircraft's wings and circled back. It floated along the runway for 100 feet before the pilot could finally get it down. He quickly throttled back and taxied to where the truck was parked on the edge of the field. The deserted town was a few 100 yards behind them, a clutch of crumbling buildings that the desert was slowly consuming. A ramp at the rear of the aircraft slowly lowered, reminding Nina of a medieval drawbridge. A man she didn't recognize emerged and approached the group. "Nina," he asked, yelling over the engine's noise. Nina stepped toward him.
"I'm Nina Visser."
"Hi," he said in a friendly tone. "Dan Singer wanted me to tell you that the United States government has a program called Echelon." With it, they can listen to just about any electronic conversation in the world.
So?
You should be more careful what you say over a satellite phone, because someone was listening last night. Even as his words were sinking in, Cabrillo dropped his easy demeanor and whipped a pistol from behind his back, aiming it at Nina Visser's tall forehead. Three more men charged down the Caribou's ramp, led by Link. Each was armed with an MP5 machine pistol, and they swept their guns from person to person.
"Hope you guys like it out here," Juan continued. "We're on a rather tight schedule and don't have time to haul you into the police."
One of the environmentalist fanatics shifted his weight to lean closer to their truck. Juan fired a bullet close enough to his foot to gouge the edge of his rubber-soled boot.
"Think again."
Link kept the environmentalists covered, clearing the way for Juan to cut Jeff Merrick free while the other two corporation men bound each of the kidnappers with plastic flex cuffs. Merrick was unconscious and his shirt was caked with dried blood. Julia was aboard the Oregon tending to the wounded freedom fighters from Zimbabwe, but one of her orderlies had made the flight. Juan turned Merrick over to the medico and stepped back out into the sunlight carrying two jerry cans of water.
"If you ration this, it should last a week or so."
He tossed the cans into the back of the truck. He searched the vehicle and found Nina's satellite phone in the glove compartment. He also came away with a couple of assault rifles and a pistol.
"Kids shouldn't play with guns," he said over his shoulder as he returned to the plane.
Then he paused and came back to the group.
"I almost forgot something."
He scanned their faces and spotted the person he wanted, trying to hide behind a large bearded kid. Juan walked over and yanked Susan Dunleavy's arm. The guy protecting her made to swing at Cabrillo's head. The effort was clumsy, and Juan easily ducked the blow, coming up with his 9mm pressed firmly between the collegian's startled eyes.
"Care to try that again?"
The kid stepped back. Juan cinched Susan Dunleavy's cuffs tight enough to let her know there was going to be worse to come, and frog-marched her to the plane. At the ramp, he paused and addressed the two team members who were going to remain behind. They had manhandled a rubber bladder of fuel for the truck off the plane.
"You know the drill?"
"We'll drive about 30 miles deeper into the desert and dump them."
"That way the plane Singer sent will never find them," Juan said. "Just don't forget to get the GPS coordinates so we can get them later."
"Then we drive back to Windhoek, stash the truck someplace, and get a hotel room."
"Check in with the ship as soon as you arrive," Juan said and shook their hands.
"Maybe we can get you out before we go after the guns up north in the Congo." Just as Cabrillo was about to disappear inside the Caribou with his prisoner, he shouted at the environmentalists, "See you in a week." Link trotted after him, and as soon as he was aboard, Tiny gunned the engines. 90 seconds after touching down, they were aloft again, leaving behind 8 slack-jawed, would-be eco-terrorists who never knew what hit them.